Put that on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with dads on the air.
And this is Dads on the Air. Welcome back on this bright, sunny morning, the 19th of January 2010. This is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio with me I have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning everybody.
Also in the studio we have Philip York from Dads in Distress.
A big hello to everyone.
And we've got a lot happening at the moment. First of all, we'll be talking about some interesting news stories that have caught our eye during the week. Then we'll be speaking to Dr. Bruce Robinson, who has been on our show before on 2nd of September 2008, for those who are keeping note of this. And Bruce is a practicing medical specialist. He's professor of medicine at a university in Perth, and it's very hot over there in Perth at the moment. I think they had one of the hottest days ever yesterday. We'll also be speaking to Sue Price because of some very strange developments that have been going on, and also we want Sue to talk about her campaign to send a postcard to the politicians. But first of all, we might just look at a couple of those news stories. Ian, I think you've got something for us.
Well, this is a bit of a sort of tragedy comedy out of the United States, a bit of sort of light relief under the heading Divorce for Dying Hopper. Richard Simpson in Los Angeles has written, actor Dennis Hopper has filed for divorce from his fifth wife on his deathbed. The star of Easy Rider, Rebel Without a Cause and Apocalypse Now has prostate cancer and is said to have less than a month to live after the disease spread to his bones. In his final days, Hopper, 73, has separated from his wife and is understood to be trying to cap the amount she will receive from his will. Hopper and Victoria Duffy, 41, married 14 years ago and have a daughter, Galen, who turns 7 in March. Court papers list the separation date as last Tuesday and offers to pay his wife support as opposed to her giving him life support or something. Anyway, he also requests joint legal and physical custody of Galen, which you would think would be a bit strange if he's going to be dead. Miss Duffy is understood to be furious after discovering that her inheritance would be exactly what she had agreed to under the couple's prenuptial agreement and no more, despite their relatively long marriage. It's truly a tragedy, and sadly it's all about the money and who inherits what, a friend of the couple said. So there you go, silliness is still alive in the United States, even though they're dying.
And speaking of silliness, there's an unbelievable story by Sophie Borland. It's headed Businessman Sues BA for Treating Men Like Perverts.
Yeah, this is a cracker, this one. This is ridiculous.
It's very hard to believe this story, although we have heard rumours for quite some time. It really is a case of British Airways treating men as though men are sexual deviants, and perhaps the best way to achieve change is by legal action, as this particular person is doing, and his name is Mirko Fischer. In this case, a businessman is suing British Airways. He has accused the airline of branding all men as potential sex offenders and says innocent travellers are being publicly humiliated. In this case, Mr. Fischer, who's a 33-year-old hedge fund manager, became aware of the BA policy while he was flying from Gatwick with his wife Stephanie, 30. His wife, who's 6 months pregnant, had booked a window seat which she thought would be more spacious. Mr. Fischer was in the middle seat between her and a 12-year-old boy. Shortly after all the passengers had sat down, having stowed their bags, a male steward asked Mr. Fischer to change his seat. Mr. Fischer, naturally, refused, explaining that his wife was pregnant. At that point, the steward raised his voice, causing several passengers to turn around in alarm. The steward warned that the aircraft could not take off unless Mr. Fischer obeyed. Mr. Fischer eventually moved seats, but felt so humiliated by his treatment that he's taking the airline to court on the grounds of sex discrimination. He's paying all his own legal fees, and if he wins, which at the hearing, which is going to be held next month at the, now, how do you pronounce it, S-L-O-U-G-H, Slough?
Slough, yes, Slough, lovely place. I caught the train through Slough a few times myself on my way out to Reading back in the early 80s. know it well.
I think it's a setting for The Office show on television, but I've never been sure of that pronunciation. The Slough County Court, and Mr. Fisher has promised to donate any compensation to the NSPCC. This is absolutely extraordinary. As Mr. Fisher says, a plane is a public place. The cabin crew regularly walk up and down the aisles, and passengers are sat so close to each other, the risk of any abuse is virtually zero.
This is just vilification of men. I mean, there's no basis for this whatsoever. This is insanity once again. This is basically saying that men cannot be trusted with children, which is complete lunacy. All of the statistics. I mean, there's no basis for this whatsoever. This is feminist paranoia. And somehow it's managed to become, the policy of a major corporation. I think Qantas has a similar policy, don't they?
They do. They do indeed, mate. Our founder of Dads in Distress, Tony Miller, found himself in the exact same situation on a Qantas flight. He was sat next to an unaccompanied minor and was actually pushed back to the back of the plane. For no other reason than he was a man.
Well, you'd think that, I mean, if it is so important to them, you would think that they would sort it out when they were allocating seats, you know, when they were dishing out the boarding passes. I mean, why humiliate somebody? I mean, if you've got this ridiculous paranoid policy, you would think that you would administer it quietly behind the scenes rather than humiliating people in public for no other reason than the fact that they are a man. You know, I mean, this to me is just complete and utter insanity. It's disgraceful, and hopefully he will win the case, and hopefully they will reverse their policy. They will be made to see sense. You can't vilify men in this way. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yes, you can only hope that he's going to be successful in this case. The fact that he's being denied being able to sit next to his pregnant wife is adds an extra factor to it, but. Why all men should be branded because of some outcries about the isolated case is ridiculous.
If you look at the percentage of the population that are pedophiles, I mean it's a minuscule. It's a fraction of 1%.
Yep, and as you said earlier, Ian, you know the actual statistics show that children are at most at risk. By females,
well,
by their mother. So
yeah, men protect and provide for children, and this is something that society needs to wake up to. This is the fact: men protect children. We are not dangerous. We are there to protect children. We protect all children. This is what community is about. Anybody who sees a child in distress in any situation has an obligation to aid that child. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty much across the board, and most men, 99%. Probably 7 or 8% of men would immediately assist a child in distress in most circumstances. So this kind of lunacy from paranoid feminist propaganda, this has got to go. This is madness. This is absolute madness.
Yes, if you follow the logic where children are most at risk from their own parents, British Airways will have to stop any parents sitting with their children on planes.
Well, mothers especially. It's mothers who are the most likely to kill and harm a child. Is its mother. So what are they going to enact a policy where children are not allowed to sit next to their mother on an aeroplane? I mean, how stupid. Madness. The world's getting sillier every day. Sillier every day.
Now, Philip, did you have something you wanted to mention there?
Just further to the report that we read out last week in regards to, let me just get it up here, sorry, Fury at ruling in the custody battle. Our regular listeners may remember we reported last week a mother found by the family court to be violent, untruthful, lacking moral values and responsible for the psychological and emotional abuse of her children has been given custody of them. The father that was deemed principal and with much to offer his children has been effectively banned from seeing his daughters. Our very own rockin' pop, Peter van der Voorde, has released a blurb on this to the media as well, and if I can, I'd just like to share it with everyone. Fury at Reeling in Custody Battle is an excellent article which succinctly describes everything that is wrong with the international family justice system and the dysfunctional way our so-called enlightened society administers the protection of our children's right to a continued relationship with both their parents. Laurie Knoll, the Australian journalist who wrote the story, should be congratulated for the outstanding way he describes a modern-day child-stealing racket that is rotten to the core. It clearly shows how this racket has degenerated into a multi-billion dollar international industry, which is allowed to play God and sabotage our children's fundamental human rights to their parents and child relationships. Peter goes on to say, as can be seen in Laurie's article, the family justice industry has many tentacles, all of which are deeply involved with the cruel removal of innocent children from loving parents. That this should be allowed to continue for 35 years and now into the 21st century is beyond belief, and a sad reflection on how each generation refuses to learn from history. If we are to learn anything, it is that the poorly written so-called Howard Family Law Amendments of Australia in 2006, as predicted by many, have done nothing to change the dysfunctional culture existing in the family justice industry, of which the family court is the symbolic head. A family court which rewards criminals and punishes their helpless victims is no longer representative of a court of justice. Worse still, asleep at the wheel, our elective representatives either do not see what is happening or turn a blind eye to the corrupt and or incompetent behaviour of all those involved with the child removal racket. However, this does not lessen the morally indefensible behaviour of those dispelling so-called justice in international family courts and their mercenary fellow predators, who enjoy stripping the family wealth and destroying the parent-child relationships of unsuspecting citizens. The reason for this absence of a large-scale public outcry is perhaps due to the fact our communities have become desensitized to the daily horror stories of state-sponsored child abuse, as detailed in Laurie Knoll's article. There is also the existence of a feeling of helplessness experienced by our ordinary citizens to stop the family court abomination, which cruelly postures as a kind of helpful administrator of family justice. Well documented by many, including high-profile human rights campaigners such as Sir Bob Geldof and Professor Stephen Baskerville, whose writings provide the world with a clear picture of the atrocities committed by this industry, leaves the proponents and perpetrators no plausible defence of the indefensible. The world accepted slavery as a legal normality for 300 years, ignoring all those calling for a halt to such a morality, indefensible human rights abuse. So why have we learned nothing from history?
And what better way to introduce the next track, which is actually by Peter van der Voort himself. This is off his album Our Stolen Children. This is a track called No One Is Listening. Well, Peter, let's hope somebody is listening today. Let's hope that your well-thought-out article there does actually land on some fertile soil. This is Peter van der Voort.
No one is listening to the children at home.
we're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air on this 19th day of January 2010. In the studio is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and I'm with Ian Purdy and Philip York. I've got a note here from our own Greg Andresen, who has sent me two papers by the Australian Institute for Suicide Research and Prevention at Griffith University that have been accepted for publication. In early 2006, the Australian Institute for Suicide Research and Prevention undertook a study into suicide behaviours titled An Investigation into Suicidal Behaviours by Males During the Marital and De Facto Separation Process. The background is that marital separation, as distinct from divorce, is rarely researched in the suicide literature. Studies usually report on the statuses of separated and divorced as a combined category, possibly because demographic registries are not able to identify separation reliably. However, in most countries, divorce only happens once the process of separation has settled, which in most cases occurs a long time after that initial breakup. So the aim of this study was that to investigate whether separation might carry a far greater risk of suicide than divorce. So the present study investigated the impact of separation on suicide risk by taking into account the effects of age and gender. Now, this article was received, it was available online from the 6th of January 2009, so it's been out for a little while, but it's certainly current. The results of the study during the examined period were that 6,062 persons died by suicide in Queensland. That's an average of 551 cases per year, with males outnumbering females by 4-1. This confirms a lot of what Dads in the Air have been saying for quite a while. For both males and females, separation created a risk of suicide at least four times higher than any other marital status. The risk was particularly high for males aged 15 to 24. So the conclusions of the study were that the study highlights a great variation in the incidence of suicide by marital status, age and gender, which suggests that these variables should not be studied in isolation. Furthermore, particularly in younger males, separation appears to be strongly associated with the risk of suicide.
And if you compare that to the road toll, the figures from suicide, you know, they dwarf the road toll. The amount of money and resources that we've been putting rightly into trying to do something about the road toll, I mean, very little is being done about male suicide, or if you compare it even to death from drugs or any other category of you know, death, basically, for this especially vulnerable age group of men. Suicide is the prevailing cause of death, which everybody, you know, the government doesn't seem to have any policy. I mean, there's Beyond Blue and all of these other organisations that are doing great work out in the community, Dads in Distress, obviously. But the government just seems to be turning its back on this particular issue. It's not taking it seriously at all.
Yes, and I'm sure there's a dark figure in those figures as well from the Queensland Suicide Register, because we know that many suicides are not recorded as suicides. In fact, when there are single participant driver deaths, frequently that's reported as something other than suicide.
Yep, someone just drives into a tree. You know, who's to know? Out on a lonely country road, just drives into a tree. They find, oh, he had alcohol or something in his system, so they put that down to another death from alcohol, and they ramp up the fines and get more booze buses out there, but that wasn't the cause.
And just going off what you were saying a minute ago, Ian, I mean, not only is the government not doing much about it, through the Child Support Agency, you'd have to say they are one of the causes.
They are. They are a perpetrator, and we have the figures on our website, dadsontheair.net. We estimate the number of people who have, the number of Child Support Agency clients, they like to call them, who have died since Kevin Rudd has been Prime Minister. We have the, what is the figure? Anybody aware of what the figure is at the moment?
Last time I looked, I think it's something about 9,500 since Kevin Rudd was elected.
So if you compare that to the number of people who died on the roads, it dwarfs the figure of the number of people who died on the roads in Australia. And I'm sure a lot of the people included in our figure on our website actually did die on the roads. But they happen to be child support agency clients. And, of course, it's just put down to some sort of accident or whatever. But they don't look at the true cause, which is family breakup, which is man agony, basically.
Yeah, so we've got the government agencies of the family court and the child support agency, I think, have some responsibility, a large part of the responsibility for that very high rate of suicides, of male suicides, with the link with family problems.
Well, it's just society. I mean, it's all this man bashing. I mean, we were talking about, you know, the British Airways and Qantas policies of not allowing men to sit beside children on aeroplanes. I mean, how are men supposed to feel who are dispossessed, separated from their families, treated like lepers, not allowed to sit next to children on aeroplanes? You know, obviously men get extremely disgruntled. I mean, you know, we are taxpayers, we are workers, we contribute immensely to this society. In fact, I would go as far as to say that a society's greatest resource is its menfolk. And we are just being absolutely shamed and slandered and treated like crap. And it's got to stop. It's because if this continues, I mean, this is chewing away at the pillars upon which our civilization is based. If we don't redevelop some kind of respect for men, and the majority of men are serious, sound, intelligent, worthy beings who are worth respecting. They should be treated with respect. None of this vilification, which has just become commonplace, which has become corporate policy, which we see on television, we see in advertising. It's got to stop. It's no good for anybody. It's not just men who are suffering. It's the whole of our society. The whole of our civilization is being undermined.
Yes, if this is a pendulum, I think we'd have to say it's gone way too far in one direction, and we can only hope that before long it starts swinging back to some sensible approach in all these areas of family law and dealing with men.
We'll be right back. got a bloody right to say. Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back. With Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air. And our next guest is the author, Dr. Bruce Robinson. Bruce Robinson is Professor of Medicine at the University of Western Australia Medical School, and he's been speaking on the topic of work and family life to students and professional community groups for over 12 years. Bruce is the author of several books, including Fathering from the Fast Lane, Daughters and Their Dads, What Kids Really Need from Their Dads, the Blue Book of Tips for Fathers and Father Figures. Bruce was previously on the show back on the 2nd of September 2008. Are you there, Bruce?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I believe it's pretty hot over there in Perth at the moment.
Yeah, it's been really hot the last few days.
Yeah, I think I saw yesterday was the hottest day on record. So, anyway, thank you for joining us. And I believe you've been on TV recently with in the morning shows and talking in particular about the influence of fathers and how they can perhaps reduce the incidence of drug taking their children. I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, that came from a research project we undertook, and the project was designed to work out how you could get fathers more involved in drug prevention with kids. And the reason we did that was that we'd heard statistics that said that kids without a strong father figure are about twice as likely to become drug addicts. Anyway, so we did a research project, and basically what came out of that was firstly, don't wait until they're teenagers before you talk to them about drugs, or actually before you try to make a connection with your kids. Don't wait till then. Get connected early and be close to your kids, and then they will feel more worthwhile. And so they say, look, I don't need drugs. And the second thing we learnt was you can't write books and stuff as much as I've written books. Men don't tend to read books. You've got to make a DVD and about dads and kids and get it into school. So we did that as well. So that's basically how we got into it.
So you'd recommend, would the fathers perhaps sit down with their children, say, once a week in a formal setting, or how's the best way to get that message across?
No, I don't think that works, actually. I used to imagine you could go out with your kids and have a milkshake and have a serious heart-to-heart, but I think, well, first of all, rule number one, I think, is don't wait until they're teenagers before you start to pay attention to the risks that they face, be it drugs or pregnancy or anything. Don't wait till they're teenagers and they're faced with those risks before you intervene. You have to form the relationship early, right from when they're babies and toddlers. Form that warm and loving relationship. Get onto it straight away. And then when they're teenagers, you will have earned the right to be listened to and you would have made them feel worthwhile. And that's the first and probably the most important rule. But the second rule is to talk to kids about anything. You can't set up a special time. It doesn't really work. You have to teach on the run. And because there are teachable moments that come up all the time in life. But you have to be there as a dad to teach them. So, for example, watching TV, something comes up, then you can talk to your kids about it afterwards, or driving the car, listen to the radio, or talking to them about parties and stuff. What is it, you know, that happens at parties? Teachable moments occur in their time, not in your time.
Yeah, so it's really, the fathers have to spend time with their children, and I think this comes back to what used to be promoted as quality time, which I always struggled with, because going along with what you're just saying, I think it's the amount of time that you spend with your children that's going to be important and give you those opportunities that are just going to arise.
Yeah, I actually think it's both. There's plenty of dads who spend plenty of time hanging around with their kids, but they never do anything intentional about these things. And quality time doesn't work either. So my view of this is that quality time is important, but it's built on a foundation of quantity. And that's, of course, where the teachable moments come in. So, for example, a father has lots of times with his kids but doesn't seize on those teachable moments to pass on values and to pass on to kids a sense of how wonderful they are, that is, the kids, has missed the opportunity. So quantity by itself isn't going to do it, nor is quality by itself. It has to be both.
And do you see a special role for fathers, I mean, as distinct from, say, one-parent families? Do you think you'd see the influence of the father as being a special influence on the children?
Absolutely. I mean, statistically, that's convincing. The reason I think... I mean, there's lots of reasons for that. One of those reasons is that if there's a sole parent family, usually mums, but not always, they're pretty busy getting food on the table and looking after the kids. It's kind of hard to get time to do all these extra things. It's particularly an important issue for boys and their mothers because, of course, when they get hormones, they don't want to be told what to do by a woman. But also, I think there's something deeper than that, and that is, and this is particularly an issue for the parent who's not in the house, again, usually but not always the father, who has lost interest in spending time with the kids, or maybe just can't handle the heartache of leaving them behind all the time, dropping them off. And that is, a child can say, I guess I'm just not worth spending time with. I mean, a sense of worth in a child is one of the most important things we can give them. I mean, if you want to talk about protection against drugs, why is it that one child can say, no thanks, I don't need this? They have to have a sense of worth in life. They have to have a sense that they've got some quality, some specialness in life. And that comes from both parents. And if a father doesn't bother, then it's easy for a child to think, I guess I'm not worth bothering with. If, for example, a father is dead, died in a car accident or in the war or something, a child doesn't feel the same way. If Dad was here, he would have been there. He would have, been at my football match or whatever, but because he's dead, he can't be there. But when Dad just doesn't bother, a child thinks they're not worth bothering about.
I can believe that would be disastrous. Now, I think you've put some tips on for fathers with practical ideas for busy dads. That was, I think that was the subtitle of your book, Fathering from the Fast Lane. So I wonder if you could just pass on some of those tips from your book as to what busy dads should do to keep up that contact.
Yeah, actually, let me just say one thing about tips. It came up for discussion with some friends last night. My books have a certain style, which is I interview lots of people. And not only is that interesting because the people are interesting, but more importantly, they give me ideas on what has worked and what hasn't worked. In other words, all the tips are road tested.
Yes.
And you can always make up tips in your head, but if they don't work, what's the point? So they're kind of road tested ideas that people can use. All my books are full of tips. Let me give you one tip maybe, and it comes to do with that feeling of worth. And that is for dads to do special things with their kids one-on-one. So if they have three children, that's three separate things. And it might just be a dad date where they go out and have dinner and watch a movie. But one of the best things you can do is to take each child on a trip. just dad and just the child, not with mum and not with your mates and not with all the kids. If, again, three kids would mean three separate trips. And we talked before, Bill, about making a child feel worthwhile. There's nothing... And in fact, the busier a father is, the more worthwhile a child feels when dad spends special time one-on-one with them, because they think, gee, my dad's really busy. I must be worth spending time with. And I remember a friend of mine really busy, took his son on such a trip. And his son just thought, well, that's great, but I'll just be hanging around dad while he's at his conference. And they arrived in Los Angeles, and his dad said to him, well, Ryan, what do you want to do? He said, what do you mean? Aren't we going to your conference? He said, no, we've got 3 days. It's up to you. I'll do anything you want. He said, you're kidding. No, right? It's your choice. I will do anything you want to do. He said, well, shall we go to Disneyland? Fine. You want to go to Disneyland? We'll spend the whole day there. The next day, what do you want to do? Again, he said, and he didn't stop talking about it for 10 years, how fantastic that made him feel, that his busy and successful dad was willing not only to take him, but to let him choose what to do, that he was worth spending time with.
Yeah,
that's a tip that I'd recommend for any dad, to do one-on-one things with their kids. Don't use them as an opportunity to go and point the finger at them and tell them how disappointed they are in their exam results or their room being untidy, but tell the kids how fantastic they are and how much they love being with them and how special they are.
Yes, we're speaking with Dr. Bruce Robinson from University of Western Australia. Bruce, that those tips that you mentioned, and they're contained in your book, Fathering from the Fast Lane, Daughters and Their Dads. I must admit, I've often thought that sometimes fathers don't appreciate the benefits and the pleasure they get from one-on-one time or just spending time with the children until sometimes after the divorce, and then they have the Wednesday night saga of McDonald's, but nevertheless, they do get to spend that time with the children, and I think it's something that both the children and the fathers are going to get a lot out of. So perhaps that's something you can learn from the disaster of the family breakup.
And it is a shame, isn't it? If and this does happen, I've heard it many times, where dad doesn't spend time with the kids until the divorce. And then he's got them. So now he has to, be able to look in their school bag and find the note under the apple core and, basically pay attention to them. And then he realizes it's actually fun. And he wishes he could have his time all over again, but he can't. So he makes the best of what he can under those circumstances. And then if he's in that situation, it comes all around again, then he doesn't make the same mistake twice. I mean, one of the things that breaks my heart is hearing those stories, because I think, why isn't there someone around when a bloke's working hard and he's got young tackers, before they've even gone to school, why isn't there someone looking at him and saying, mate, work is not that important, mate. It's important, but it's not that important. Get in there and have fun with your kids, because you know what? You'll enjoy it as well as them. But, it's really sad. And then they live with regrets afterwards, and I think, gee, wouldn't it be great if people could seize the moment now and not live with those regrets.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. You don't get those times back again, do you? The opportunities to see your child in his football team or whatever, if you just let it pass, it's not going to come back again.
And that's honestly, Bill, why I write these books. I mean, I'm a busy doctor, I don't need to write books, but it's the frustration of seeing this happening time and time again, and I think, well, if someone knew someone and bought a book and just put it in the Christmas stocking and said, mate, read this, then there's just a chance that people would be helped. And, the fact that people do read them and are helped is, I guess for me, makes it worthwhile.
Yes, I think your books that I've read seem mainly to be directed to intact families. Have you done any work with those separated dads?
Yeah, in the first book, Fathering from the Fast Lane, I talk about the fact that the information contained in the book applies pretty much whether you live in the same house as their mother or not. So, for example, what I talked about, trips with kids or how you talk to kids and all that sort of stuff and ideas on dad dates, all of these things doesn't matter actually whether you live in the same house or not.
Mm.
In fact, and the book... Daughters and Their Dads, which focuses on that particular relationship, it's got a whole chapter on separated dads and, you know, what's important about it, what are the difficulties about it, some ideas that people have used who are separated and things that have worked for them. And the DVD we made, What Kids Really Need From Their Dads, the one that's been shown in all the schools, that's also got a whole thing on how you handle separation.
Yes, because it's unfortunately becoming more and more common, isn't it? The yeah, that was in 2007, I think, that DVD came out.
Yeah, it's but it's still going around the schools. It's gone to every school in WA. I know it's gone to a lot of the schools in Victoria. I think every school in the ACT is getting it this year. So it's getting out there. It goes for about 20 minutes. If anyone wants it, in other words, anyone's listening who wants to get a copy, they can get it from the University of Western Australia Fathering Project. It's called, well, the website is www.thefatheringproject.org. And they can get it and show it in their school or workplace or church or wherever they happen to be.
That's right, the website www.thefatheringproject.org, and we're speaking with Dr. Bruce Robinson. We might just go to a break, and we'll be back in a moment.
The devil inside.
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, and we're speaking with Dr. Bruce Robinson, who is an author and a professor of medicine at the University of Western Australia. Bruce, Ian Purdy in his geo has a question he's been burning
to
ask you.
I do indeed. Thanks, Bill. Yeah, Bruce, I was just wondering if there's any difference in the way that a father should handle drug education when dealing with a girl as opposed to dealing with a boy. Is there any difference in the approach that a father should have for his daughter as opposed to his son? Can you shed any light on this one?
Yeah, and there are some differences. I mean, there are some generic things which are exactly the same.
Yep.
In terms of making kids feel special. But in terms of your question, what are the differences? I think fundamentally, boys learn as apprentices to their father or a strong father figure. And I think they probably always have. Boys have gone out hunting with their dads and farming and things, and they've learned as an apprentice. So they watch dad to see how dad functions. So, for example, for a boy, one of the worst things in terms of drug intake is if a dad takes drugs. If a dad says, don't do drugs, but I do, I mean, don't be as bad as me, it's very difficult for a boy because he's learning by an apprenticeship role. For girls, however, they look to their father or a father figure for various signals about, am I attractive and am I worthwhile and am I lovable? So,
So there is quite a lot of difference then, you're saying, because, I mean, I know in the case of my father, he smoked cigarettes up until I was about 10, and then he gave them away. He just stopped, and he stopped dead, and he never smoked again. And I've never smoked cigarettes and never felt inclined to, and, you know, I'm thinking I probably emulated him, saw that he realized that it was a mistake, and that's saved me having to go through, the problems of nicotine addiction. Yeah. Also, with alcohol, I mean, alcohol is a drug that basically our society is floating in alcohol. That's quite a difficult one, and there's been a lot of advice lately for saying that you shouldn't introduce your children to alcohol too young. If you can put it off till they're, 15, 16, 17, 18, they will have a better chance later in life of dealing with alcohol, or less chance of becoming alcohol dependent or alcoholic. Does this apply? I mean, with drugs, I guess it's different because they tend to get drugs from their peers. It seems to me like, if it comes to them at school, if, the cool kid in the class is suddenly handing joints of marijuana around or lines of speed or Ritalin or, even medication drug, then it's more likely that perhaps more of the kids are going to follow that sort of behaviour. And in those cases... a parent's role modelling is possibly minimised. What do you think about that?
Role modelling is important. However, lots of parts of your question there, but I think all kids are going to experiment with drugs. The issue isn't so much experimentation, having alcohol or whatever. The issue is one of sustaining that behaviour where it becomes part of your lifestyle rather than being something... you just try and then you say, look, this isn't for me, guys. And the reason someone says this isn't for me, guys, is partly it might be a role model. I think a role model is powerful in a kid's life, and like I mentioned, more powerful for a boy from a father.
Yep, definitely.
He watches, he learns from his father how to be a man, how to function as a man. But also that feeling of worthwhileness and, I don't need this. I've got another way I want to live my life. I don't want to live my life this way. But girls are different, and I remember a very poignant discussion I had. In fact, I can still remember this discussion with crystal clarity, even though it's about 5 years ago. I talked to a girl who was in a heroin rehabilitation house, and she described how she became an angry young teenage girl at about 14, and she would swear at her father, and she just became angry. The hormones hit her, and I don't know, she couldn't even understand it. And she said, I don't blame my father. I don't blame him. I don't hold him responsible. I know it was my responsibility. I got into drugs. But then she said something I've never forgotten. She said, but I knew he loved me, but he just didn't know what to do. I believe that if he just reached out and hugged me, I wouldn't have become a drug addict.
Yeah, well, that's pretty profound, isn't it?
That embodies something for girls, you know. It's when teenagers become the most obnoxious. It's when they need the most love, and it's when they often get the least.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting.
And that's probably the hardest time for the parents to do the hugging and supporting, I suppose. They're probably going off there dealing with their own problems and looking at the child and thinking, well, that's a little so-and-so. I don't want to get involved. So it's not easy being parents either, is it?
Well, it's not easy, but, you know, people say to me, how can you discipline a child without destroying that sense that you love them? And I think that's one of the commonest questions I get at seminars. And I say, look, there's different ways of disciplining your children. You know, you're not their pal, so you have to discipline them. And if they say they're going to be home at 11 and they get home at 12, you have to discipline them. But, you know, there's two basic ways. You can say, you stupid child, or you're worthless, or, you know, you've upset us again, you're no good, and especially if you're angry. Or you can say things like, oh, you're better than that. We're going to work it out together. You're better than that. You're grounded, of course, but, you know, you're better than that. I believe in you.
Well, even grounding and taking any disciplinary action, I've been observing, I think there are so many parents out there who are now afraid to parent. They're so much involved with, as you're saying, you know, being their best mate or, you know, getting on with them, being friends, not prepared to, you know, like, I suppose it's like a coach in a rugby team, but, you know, you can't be one of the players all the time. You've got to be able to step outside and do your parenting.
Well, I think you're right, and I think this idea that you have to be your children's friend does stop people. People are afraid that their children will not like them anymore. I can tell you this is particularly a problem for separated parents.
Yes.
You know, the separated parent wants to be, you know, liked by their children, and it's quite common, therefore, for one of the separated parents, and frankly mostly the dad, to pull back on discipline because they want to be liked and just to have good times without discipline. So then all the disciplining is left to the mother, and of course then that just creates problems.
Yes, and, I mean, and when you see you're on a monetary side, you see your money's going to be divided in half, so spending a couple of $100 on a child seems like nothing. The father might be prepared to spend it, but actually it's not doing any good to promote that sort of desperation of trying to be friends with them.
Negotiation with the child's mother is important about things like discipline and consistency and a united message, and that is for the children's benefit. You know, people love their kids, and they want it to happen for the child's benefit.
Yeah, so let's hope that can be promoted. We've been speaking with Dr. Bruce Robinson, and Bruce, thank you very much for coming onto the show today. Just a reminder of that website, www.thefatheringproject.org, and on that site you'll be able to get the DVD, What Kids Really Need from Their Dads. And is there access for your books on that site as well, Bruce?
The best place to go, of course, the books are available for example, online at the bookstores, Dimex, those sort of things. They don't tend to be on the shelves because men don't read books, so they don't keep them on the shelves. Although some bookstores have them on the shelves. But the simplest way to get that information is actually to go to my own website, which is
www.brucerobinson.com.au. Okay, www.brucerobinson.com.au, and I have to say I've seen them in my local library, Bruce, so that's perhaps another avenue for people as well.
Yeah, and then on that website there's a link to fathering, and then the resources pop up there.
Okay, well, look, thank you again for coming on the show, and we'll be back in a moment.
Welcome.
Sure.
grows so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. And we have as our next guest Sue Price, the Director of Men's Rights Agency. Sue's becoming a regular on the show, but there's so much happening in the area of changes to the family law and the child support agency. Now, Sue, are you there, Sue?
Yes, good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Sue, you've got a campaign running at the moment called Send a Politician a Postcard, and I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about that.
Yes, I can. We're absolutely sick and tired of the misinformation that's being promoted as being the reason for this rolling back of the shared parenting. So we've designed three postcards, and they're designed to be sent in a series. You know, you start with one, then go through the next one and the final one. And the first one is about men are victims of domestic violence. And we have rather a nice illustration of a poor man who's had a biff on the nose and a black eye. And the caption on it is, "It's amazing what my wife can do with a fry pan, with a frying pan."
And our database has been updated.
Sorry about that. That's my computer going berserk. And we give facts such as, did you know in Queensland, 39.9% of domestic violence orders are issued to protect men? In New South Wales, 28.9% of domestic assault victims are men. In South Australia, 32.3% of victims who reported domestic violence by a current or ex-partner were male. So, you know, we've got the information there. That's the first one. The next one is Dads Are Not Demons. That's dealing with the issue of child abuse and murder of children. And sadly to say, I know it's pretty awful to have to say this, but mothers are by far in the majority when it comes to homicide of children, and also physical assault, neglect, and such like.
You'd never know it from the from what you read in the paper and the general publicity, would you?
No, well, you wouldn't. That's one of the problems. There's been a whole heap of misinformation, statistics that have been hidden, that have been hidden by definition. They will talk about fathers, but what they really mean is the man living in the house who may be the a perpetrator of abuse. Like, mothers' boyfriends are very high in the list of both the homicide and physical abuse and sexual abuse, of course, of children. So we've actually listed the last Australian Institute of Criminology, their National Homicide Monitoring Program in 2006-2007, needed to be corrected to come up with the correct figures, which are 11 mothers, five mothers' partners and five biological fathers murdered their children. That's 11 mothers and five of their partners. So that's a pretty high ratio, 3-1 against biological fathers being responsible. And we also give a table from the WA child abuse data, which talks about who actually perpetrated any abuse on the children, neglect, emotional, physical, sexual, and it shows that mothers and mothers' boyfriends, again, or other males in the family or other males known to the family, are the major perpetrators of abuse. It's all useful information, and we need to get this out to the politicians to tell them what you're reading about in the newspapers, the information that's being put in front of you, is wrong. You know, they need to see this information and they need to take it on board.
Yes, it's extraordinary, the amount of misinformation, and there's also the site of our own Greg Andreessen, the 1 in 3 site, which is another way of getting the correct information.
Well, that was a brilliant initiative of Greg's, and he's put a lot of hard work into that, and I know for a fact that the statistics he refers to are correct. I've put some things forward to him, and he's checked them and put them up, and he's very thorough in what he does, in the work that he does.
Yes, I think
so
that's
they are reliable.
That's his skill, is the research, and he's
absolutely
puts the effort into it.
Absolutely. And our final postcard is an interesting one. We wondered what to do for the last one, but we thought we chose one with a lovely photograph of a dad and his daughter, and we have a caption saying, "Mummy and Daddy taught me to share. Now it's their turn to share their time with me." And we've used an extract from an article written by Stephanie Ramage, who's a journalist, an overseas journalist, but she actually rejected a well-paid job offered interstate, preferring to settle on equal shared care, staying in the familiar surroundings where she'd been married. And she says, "As I looked around at other divorced mothers, I became almost panicked by what I saw. Sons who seized with resentment against their mother, whom they felt sure had driven away their fathers, and daughters who so desperately wanted a dad in their lives that they would latch on to just about any male authority figure who came along. Though some now departed dads were truly bad news, in others, mothers merely cooked up a tale of atrocities committed by their former hubbies as part of a propaganda campaign to justify daddy's exile from their child. When I asked other mums why a father isn't as much of a parent as a mother, they were speechless and furious. They were afraid of what people would think if they were not the main carer." So that's the main purpose of that card, is to point out that it is a choice that both parents make. We need parents to be less selfish than they've been in the past, and to consider the children and consider the relationship the other parent has with their children. We've also got there's a little mention on the bottom of that which deals with the attachment theory, which is being reinvigorated by a psychologist called Jennifer McIntosh, and supported by Richard Chisholm, who was one of the authority figures behind the inquiries into family violence and family law. And they've resurrected an attachment theory position that was determined in 1951 by a chap called John Bowlby. He was asked to see if children needed a primary attachment to a particular person, and he used as his samples children who'd actually lost both parents during the war. And 6 years later, he admitted that fathers hadn't really been taken into consideration, and he conceded that they were very valuable to their children's lives and should be taken into consideration. And, of course, there's been other research since then that shows that babies are equally affected by having contact with their dad as they are with their mum. They equally miss that contact with both parents, whether it's mother or father. There's no difference.
Yes,
so that last part of it is the reasoning behind the that children under two should not have shared care with their other parents.
Yes, we want to come back and talk to you about that, but just on that too, it's Relationships Australia, which is no doubt very influential in the government, has also seized on Jen McIntosh's views on Relationships Australia, on attachment theory.
Yeah, from what I understand, she's considered the guru on this, and she's almost a godlike figure in taking account of her words, and I find her research is extremely shallow. She's one of these people who tends to refer to her own research as being qualified and recognisable to justify the opinions that she puts forward in the next piece of research.
Yes, just coming back to the postcard campaign,
yep.
Sue, you're suggesting that people order postcards and send a protest to politicians, and I guess it's modelling on the what happened with the Liberal Party and the Green policy. Is that seem to have a marked effect?
Well, we're hoping that people will decide, look, this issue is really important. They can do it so simply. All they need to do is send us a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we can send the 3 cards back to them. No charge to them whatsoever. They can then send them off to their federal politician. If they want more cards, if they want to send cards to their senators as well, and there are 12 senators in each state apart from the ACT and Northern Territory, which only have 2 senators, send us a bigger envelope with more stamps on it, and we'll send back 39 cards, which will take it into account. Otherwise, if they really want to say, it's over to you, please will you do it, they can send us a payment by their credit card, by direct banking, by cheque to us, and we will send the cards off to them signed by the, with the authority to put their name on the cards as coming from them. So it costs $2.50 for the 3 cards for the federal members only, $5 if they want one senator only added to that. And if they want it to all federal members and all their federal member and all 12 senators, it's $28. That only covers us for postage and handling, as you can imagine. It's 55 cents to post a postcard, so that's all we're covering for.
So where should they go to with that, Sue? Should they go to your website?
Well, they go to my website, and there's a link on there to the to download the paperwork, to just send that in to us, and the instructions on how to access the cards. The website is www.mensrights.com.au, and it's right up on the front page.
Okay, so that's that website, www.mensrights.com.au.
That's right.
And if you go there, you will get all the information that Sue's just been telling us about, and we can have an effect by contacting those politicians.
That's right. We've got 4,500 cars to do. If we run out of those, it's an easy job to order some more.
I'm sure you'd be delighted to run some more if the 4,500 get taken.
That's right.
We might just go for a break now, and we'll be back in a moment.
Daddy's not home. We're all alone. The tide's coming in, and the lights have just blown. TV.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. And we're speaking with Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. Sue, you've been conducting a survey recently. I wonder if you could just tell us any more on the results. I think we spoke about it last week.
24 hours ago, we launched a survey where we asked people to answer the question, will the rollback of shared parenting affect your vote? It's our contention that it is of such a serious nature, this issue, that it will affect the vote. And I think Labour Party will, in actual fact, lose a lot of voters that may have turned to them during the last election. So we launched it 24 hours ago. We are getting good results back in. I have to tell you, they're almost unanimously saying that they will not vote Labour. That's something that I think the Labour Party needs to take notice of. Of course, we need many hundreds more responses. You can't run a survey like this on just a few. You have to have a big number. And we're asking people to, you know, contact all their friends, all their relatives, send a link to the survey on to people, all the lists that they're on, put it on Twitter. I'm just still trying to master that myself, but I'm trying at least, bringing us into the 21st century with our communications. So that's what that's all about. We ask three questions of people. We ask them, did they vote Labour at the last federal election? Has the knowledge that the current reviews into the Family Law Act are likely to impact on shared parenting caused you to think more negatively about the federal Labour government? It's a yes or no answer. And then knowing that reviews to the Family Law Act will probably result in fewer children having access to both parents after separation, how likely are you to vote Labour at the next election? And you have a 1-6 answer, 1 being definitely will vote Labour, 6 being will not vote Labour. And the last one is, if you didn't know about the expected rollback of shared parenting, how likely would you have been to vote Labour at the next election? Again, it's a 1-6 choice.
And they should go to that same website, the www.
They can go to our website, and that gives them a direct link through to the survey company who holds the forms for us.
Okay, so that's www.mensrights.com.au.
That's right.
And you'll get that that information. And Sue, one other thing, while we've got you, we wanted to ask you about this some leaks that seem to be going to the media about the likelihood of the outcome of the all these studies being conducted by the federal government, and particularly with children less than 2 years old.
Well, they don't look very hopeful, do they, if the leaks are correct? And I think they are probably correct, because it is this government's and other governments' previous policy. If they're about to unload something unpalatable on the community, they tend to leak it to see what the response is going to be. And we need to be telling the politicians that the response is going to be horrendous for them. We're working on a number of plans to let the politicians know that we're not at all happy. I've put out a challenge that there'll be 1 million votes in it. I want the people to come forward and say, yes, we support what you're saying. Otherwise, we're going to have egg on our face, put it that way.
Yes, it's... you wonder what's the best way of attacking. I did see one suggestion that perhaps fathers should relent and agree to children under 1 year, that they wouldn't see their children under 1 year, but
Why would you do that, Bill?
Yes, I think...
This is the bonding time for fathers and mothers. It's the time when they get to know their child gets to know them. Why would you wait for a year or 2 years before you can actually have an interaction with your child? I know what will happen. If that comes in, what happens when the man eventually goes to apply for contact with his child? The family court will say, oh, but you haven't had any contact. Oh, we'll have to reintroduce you. We'll have to go through a stepped program of supervised contact, and then we'll see how the child responds. And if the child doesn't respond well, because it will depend on what the mother says about that, then he may find himself permanently out of that child's life. It is an absolutely outrageous proposal.
Yes, if they'd listened to our previous guest, Dr. Bruce Robinson, who emphasised the importance of children and their fathers getting together just in one area to reduce the risk of drug taking when they get a bit older.
Of course, but that interaction has to happen from when they're a baby.
That's right.
That's when the bonding takes place. And it is really important. I've mentioned before that men even have chemical changes going on in their body when they know their wife or their partner is about to give birth. And these are important chemical changes. They are a sort of preparation for the child to come into their life. And, you know, why would you reject that? Why would you prevent them, put roadblocks in the way of them getting to know their child and their child getting to know them? The basis of the attachment theory is an old hat theory that was not properly investigated at the time in 1951 when they first talked about it. It was based on the man who did the inquiry was a man called John Bowlby. He found that children who'd lost their parents through the war, they'd lost both parents, needed the attachment for a primary person. But he did admit some 6 years later that he didn't even look at fathers or the role that fathers played, and then acknowledged that yes, they do have a considerable input into their child's well-being. So why are we resurrecting these old hat theories to deny fathers a life with their children, or their children a life with their father?
Well, once again, I think it's a case of the research not being done or being slanted for a particular viewpoint.
It's being slanted, of course it is, because there is other research that's being done, Bill, that shows that children, babies, have react in the same way to both mothers and fathers, and if they don't have their father in their life, they are more likely to be stressed when they're away from both parents. So fathers do a lot of good for their children.
Yes, and it's extraordinary the way things get twisted. I guess the argument often raised is that the mother has to breastfeed the child, but it doesn't seem to worry them when they go out for dinner and they can express some milk to be used later. Or
it doesn't worry when they put them into childcare, does it?
That's right.
3 weeks old. So what are they saying? Are they saying childcare is better with processed skim milk or whatever they use these days, formula milk? Can they cope with that and they don't need the breast milk from the mother? Well, if they do that, what's the difference between a father looking after their children, I think, is far more preferable than a childcare person.
Yes, I think it's in this area it's very dangerous where there's a sort of a half-truth in there and people relate to it without really thinking it through and looking at it in a practical sense.
Look, Bill, we've seen cases where mothers have been breastfeeding their children at the age when they're 4 years old, 5 years old, for the particular purpose of using that reason to deny a father contact with his child.
Yes, it's an interesting area. But we've been talking to Sue Price. Sue, thank you once again for coming on the show and updating us in those areas.
You're very welcome.
And we look forward to talking to you again soon. Sue Price from Men's Rights Agency. And we're now going to have a break.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
for the last time today with Dad's on the Air. We've run out of time, so it's. But don't forget, you can get this show on the net if you go to www.dadsontheair.net. And just a word that next week, Australia Day, we will not be here. We'll be back the following week. So from Ian Purdy, Philip York and me, Bill Cable, it's goodbye for now and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. One last thing, stay listening for Country Bob in the show Country On, following straight after this.
We're Dads on the Air, we're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're Dads on the Air.